Are we in a new Cold War? It sometimes feels like it, as tensions between China, the US, and Russia simmer just below the surface. But keeping these dynamics from breaking into armed conflict remains possible and should be a top priority for leaders of these powers, according to Michael Doyle, author of the new book, Cold Peace: Avoiding the New Cold War. Michael is a professor at Columbia University, where he teaches in the School of International and Public Affairs, the Law School, and the Political Science Department. Here he is to share five of his big ideas.
The invasion of Ukraine is the first proxy war of the new Cold War. When Putin invaded in February of 2022, Ukraine valiantly defended itself. It is still fighting, and we do not know what the outcome will be. But what we can see is how the invasion divided the world. Russia had the diplomatic support of China and other autocracies. Ukraine has the support of NATO and its wide coalition, mostly consisting of democracies. On the other side of the world, we see something similar. President Xi Jinping threatens to reunite Taiwan with China by force and wants to be able to do so by 2027. President Biden has said the U.S. will defend the island, a self-ruling democracy. Many are thus rightly absorbed in the survival of Ukraine and the future of Taiwan. But an equally pressing question is whether the looming new Cold War that fuels the Ukraine war and Taiwan tensions can be contained. Can global strife be managed in order to rescue the vital international cooperation needed to address existential global challenges such as climate change? I recently completed Cold Peace, Avoiding the New Cold War, now being published by LiveRight W.W. Norton. It addresses both those crises and makes two large claims that I think will interest you. The first is, on the current track, the U.S. and its allies are heading into a new Cold War with Russia and China. Second, this Cold War can be averted or moderated into something I call a Cold Peace, a détente that opens the possibility of the cooperation that will be needed to address the world's many challenges, from global warming to pandemic diseases. Let me introduce myself. My name is Michael Doyle. I'm a professor at Columbia University. I also have had practical experience in international public policy. I served as UN Secretary General Kofi Annan's Assistant Secretary General for Policy Planning, and I later chaired the UN Democracy Fund, a fund set up by the US, India, and a number of other democracies in the UN to promote nonpartisan grassroots democracy. In the next five parts of this podcast, I plan to draw on the book to illustrate five insights. First, the new Cold War is new, but it also resembles the first Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Second, the instruments of the new Cold War include cyber war and industrial espionage, and all of these make for strife, but not direct military clashes. Third, the new Cold War has deep sources in changing global power dynamics between the U.S. and China, and it has sources in the domestic systems of the various rivals, including Russia, China, and the U.S., that is, the rivalry between autocracy and democracy. Fourth, despite the tension, cooperation is possible. And fifth and lastly, a Cold Peace cooperative détente will entail difficult and necessary compromises and reforms that will enable progress on the pressing global needs that we now face, such as global climate change. The first insight. The new Cold War is new, but also resembles the first Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union between 1948 and 1990. That was a revolutionary conflict over interest and legitimacy. Soviet leader Khrushchev at the UN General Assembly once threatened the West with, "We will bury you." He meant not nuclear war, but outcompete the West industrially. It was a binary, bipolar conflict between blocs, ideologies, and systems of government. Bipolar between the U.S. and the USSR, and between ideologies, capitalism and communism, and systems of government, democracy, and dictatorship. There was trust and cooperation within the blocs, that is, within NATO in the West and within the Warsaw Pact in the East, where similar values and hegemony each worked to keep the blocs together. But between the blocs, there was distrust and rivalry, and global institutions like the United Nations were marginalized. Today's new Cold War, or Cold War II, escalated with Putin's first invasion of Ukraine and conquest of Crimea in 2014. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres described the new Cold War as follows. "The Cold War is back with a vengeance," he said, "but with a difference. The mechanisms and the safeguards to manage the risks of escalation that existed in the past no longer seem to be present." This new Cold War is thus divided, like Cold War I, into two great power blocs. On the one side, the U.S., NATO, and their allies, and on the other side, Russia and China in a no-limits partnership. And between them, we see an ideological contest between democracy and autocracy, at least according to President Biden. That brings me to my second insight. The instruments of the new Cold War include not just proxy wars like the one being fought in Ukraine, but even more so cyber attacks, such as the criminal ransom warfare, as done, for example, on the Colonial Pipeline by the Russian cyber unit DarkSide, or on the JBS food chain, and more recently on hospitals, utilities, transport networks, even the New York City MTA, where they're held up for ransom if they're going to get a return of their internet systems. Other cyber attacks are cyber sabotage, including, for example, the U.S.-Israel hack on the uranium refinement process that destroyed the machinery. Another instrument is industrial espionage. China is engaged in extensive spying of U.S. aerospace and pharmaceutical industries in order to steal technology. In 2021, Microsoft Exchange experienced a hack that was led by a unit called Hafnium, which may have been backed by China. More destabilizing than these previous instruments of the new Cold War is political subversion. Russia in 2016 attempted to hack into the U.S. election, and they did the same thing within the European Union. China alleges, without much evidence, that the U.S. encouraged or organized the 2014 umbrella demonstrations in Hong Kong. The third insight is that this new Cold War has deep sources, and they're twofold. The first is what's often called the Thucydides trap. After the ancient rivalry between Athens and Sparta, 2.5 millennia ago, in which a rising Athens threatened Sparta and led Sparta to declare war to prevent the loss of its hegemony, which was the beginning of the Peloponnesian War. It's called hegemonic competition, and we see something similar in the rivalry between China and the U.S. These kinds of hegemonic rivalries arise when a challenger, think China, launches a war to win control of the global political order, or the past holder of hegemony, think the U.S., attacks in order to preserve its control. In a widely cited study by political scientist Graham Allison, he found that only four of the historic hegemonic competitions had a peaceful outcome. All the rest were resolved by preventive war and misperceptions and global wars. This was also produced by deep incentives for strategic confusion. The existing holder of hegemony seeks to sound the alarm to mobilize allies against a challenger. The challenger consistently denies and claims that it has no revolutionary ambitions. And this means that the messaging coming out of the holder and the challenger are simply designed, therefore, effectively to confuse. And this leads to strife. The second major source of strife is domestic systems. We see a contest between democracy versus autocracy. Democracies typically have short-term thinking, but they're accountable to their publics. Autocracies often take the long view, but they're unaccountable to a wide public. More contentious are economic incompatibilities. Russia and China are corporatist, which means the state either owns, directs, or manipulates through an oligopoly, an oligarchy, the entire economy, and we do see that today in China and Russia. And this is in a rivalry with market capitalism, such as is found in the U.S. and the EU, where, at least by design, the state and the private enterprises are separate. This produces deep competition. It means that Western firms think that they're competing not against Russian or Chinese firms, but against the Russian state, with all the advantages of intelligence operations and subversion faced against them. And they don't see this like typical private sector competition. Ideologies are also clashing. In Russia and China, we see claims of sovereign nationalism, and this is in confrontation with the liberal internationalism characteristic of the United States and the European Union. And this pits the liberal internationalism of human rights as a contest, a challenge to the legitimacy of Russian and Chinese autocracy, where their undemocratic governments are seen as illegitimate. And on the other side, Russia and China decry the cultural freedoms of liberal social tolerance for various genders and gay and other rights, which they see as deeply subversive of a stable cultural order. My fourth insight is that despite the tension, cooperation is possible. A cold peace détente in which mutual subversion is taken off the table and cooperation is tried can solve or attempt to solve global challenges like climate change and the pandemics, and is both desperately needed and possible. Because Cold War II is not likely to be as extreme a confrontation as was Cold War I. It's not a simple bipolar contest the way the U.S. and the USSR were in such a contest. The EU is an economic equal of the United States. The U.S. and China rivalry is predominantly security and economic, while the U.S.-Russia rivalry is predominantly security and military. It's not also a simple confrontation, and not an extreme one, like the confrontation between capitalism and communism. China in 2021 was said to have more billionaires than the U.S. It's not a communist country anymore. And many of the allies are reluctant. China has voiced some degree of reluctance with regard to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Germany, France, Japan, India sometimes doubt U.S. consistency, and they have profitable ties to Russia and China. There's also emerging a new non-aligned third world, India, various African states, also Brazil, that see the conflict in Ukraine as remote. Poverty and food are their proximate interest, and many of them want to have access to Russian grain and Russian energy in order to develop their own countries. Moreover, there are deep common interests among China, Russia, and the U.S., and the rest of the world that counter incentives for confrontation. China, the U.S., and China and the EU are each other's best customers. And even in Cold War I, we saw that there was realms for certain amounts of cooperation, as occurred, for example, during the strategic arms limitation talks to manage the nuclear standoff. And the case for arms control with China and Russia today is even stronger. The U.S., let us recall, spent $11 trillion 1990 on defense in the first Cold War. And this was against a much less dynamic USSR. China today has nearly triple U.S. population and is growing almost at twice the U.S. rate. We basically are in the position that an arms race competition with China would preclude all other global public investments in things like preventing future pandemics or dealing with global warming. My fifth and last insight, the moral case to try for the necessary compromises, regimes, and reforms that launch a cold peace, the moral case for this is overwhelming. And we can imagine what compromises might be necessary to launch this kind of a cold peace détente. They would involve, for example, support for Ukraine's self-defense, but no armed attack on Russia proper, that is, Russia in its borders before the annexation of Crimea in 2012. And it would support when Ukraine comes to realize, which is quite likely, the importance of a peace, that Crimea might well be resolved through a referendum to decide where the actual population of Crimea wants to be. Should it be with Russia? Should it be with Ukraine? That would be a legitimate form to arrive at a compromise, provided Russia is prepared to return the territory that it seized in the 2022 invasion. On Taiwan, the U.S. should formally acknowledge one China. There are historic grounds to see Taiwan and the Taiwanese people as part of the greater Chinese community. There should be, therefore, formally one China. But only if Beijing is prepared to promise that it will not use force to seize Taiwan and that instead it will attempt peaceful persuasion, not armed conquest. And this would be essential for the future of a legitimate resolution of the Taiwanese strife. On cyber, there needs to be an agreement on three no's. No cyber sabotage, no industrial tech theft, and above all, no political subversion, such as was attempted against the U.S. and the EU in 2016. Another compromise would involve the trilateralization of nuclear arms control. We need to bring China into the mix in a new SALT treaty that includes the U.S., Russia, and China especially. And last but not least, we need domestic U.S. reforms that rebuild the vibrancy of our welfare state, that restore the promise of the American middle class to enhance our democratic stability and the kind of long-run resilience we will need in light of the basically inevitable competition with China and Russia. Each of these is complicated. None will be easy. But we owe the next generation a try at cold peace cooperation in order to avoid the confrontation of a new Cold War. So let me conclude by inviting you to read more about them in this book. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. That was Michael Doyle with five big ideas from Cold Peace, Avoiding the New Cold War. You might also like our book by four, The Wires of War, Technology and the Global Struggle for Power by Jacob Helberg. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.